Welcome to The Lovumentary, a podcast dedicated to finding out the truth behind what creates deeply passionate, connected, and lasting love. In every episode, I sit down with one of the most amazing couples, love experts, or authors in the country and discuss the nitty-gritty details of what really happens inside the most incredible relationships. We dive into the good times and the bad, the sickness and the health, the richer and the poorer, and how each couple has created their own version of true love. My hope is that you take something from every single one of these stories that can help you love more fully and passionately. I'm your host, Nate Bagley, and thanks so much for tuning in. When you hold me tight, I want to feel how I want to feel forever. In this episode, Melissa and I sit down and talk to Dr. Ali Benazir, who lives in San Francisco and is a graduate from Harvard College and Cambridge University. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College, which is awesome. He's a certified hypnotherapist and an author of the book, The Tao of Dating, which is one of Amazon's highest rated dating books. So today's conversation revolves a little bit around dating, but also has a lot of application to those of you who are in relationships. We talk a lot about how to have meaningful conversations. One of my favorite conversations of the entire trip was about meditation. So we talked a little bit about that. The concept of soulmates we cover, and a lot of really other really interesting things. It's a really fast-paced conversation. We cover a lot of different topics, and I know that you'll probably love it. Hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll have another one up next week. Thank you.
Did you start by taking us through how you got into this work?
Yeah. So it all started out when I was an advisor. They call them tutors at Harvard for undergraduates. I was a pre-med advisor, and part of my job was I'd sit down with the kids and have dinner with them and listen to what's going on. And dating was a subject that came up a lot, specifically the lack of dating at Harvard. So yes, I know this, but you know, every semester, every dorm at Harvard has a little formal, and so you know that's like the social highlight of every semester. So, you know, the goal is to have a date for that. And you'd be shocked and amazed how difficult it was to scare up that one date or that once a semester thing. I'm like, wait. You're surrounded by single people who live above, below, left, and right of you. You have meals with them three times a day. You go to classes with them every day, and you still can't get a date. What is this? What's going on here? So I decided that something needed to be done and some fundamentals need to be taught. And these are people who are really good at learning stuff that came in book form. So I did a little seminar for them. And within 24 hours, the kids started getting results. So I'm like, this is good. I was emboldened. I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book. But then I end up going to Cambridge, getting a master's degree there, coming back, going to consulting, and that kind of, I started a website, but was kind of on the back burner, just kind of a fun thing. But then I realized that I was really not very well suited to soulless corporate work. And when I decided to put my money where my mouth is and be a real entrepreneur, this project came back to me, and I thought, okay, now's the time. And that's when I got started writing about this stuff in earnest, wrote a book for men, The Tao of Dating, The Thinking Man's Enlightened Guide to Success with Women, and then subsequently the book for women, The Tao of Dating, The Smart Woman's Guide to Being Absolutely Irresistible, which I think was the highest rated dating book on Amazon for like 157 weeks, which yeah. I found out later on. It's like, oh, if I add this up, that's 3 years. And so anyway. There you go.
That's awesome. Can you talk a little bit about the Tao of Dating? I know that sure. there was like five different points that you wrote in a HuffPo article that I found fascinating.
I'm not sure which one you encountered, but if there's, there are five principles that I like to talk about when it comes to using this philosophy and applying it to your love life. The first, and I think the most important, is the principle of abundance. So people are going around going, oh, there's nobody for me. All the good ones are taken. You know, all the good guys are gay. And well, you know, there's 7 billion people in the world. So if you are of one sex, that means there's 3.5 billion of the other. Right. So that's a lot. So let's say you're super hyper duper picky and there's only 1% that's good enough for you. That's, you know, 35 million. good start, right? It's super duper big. Only 1% of that is good enough for you. That's 350,000. So, you know, these are big numbers. So there is abundance. There's opportunity. There's all kinds of great people. And no matter who you are, there's somebody out there for you who's a potentially good match. I don't necessarily believe in soulmates. I think there's any number of good matches out there. So the second principle is the be, do, have principle. So be, do, have. What does that mean? So most people are looking for a result in their life. Like, I want a boyfriend. I want a girlfriend, right? And they try to go straight for the result. And then when they don't get it, they're a little disappointed. But what tends to be the real hallmark of success is to be a certain kind of person first, right? So let's say you want money. You want to be the person with that mindset of wealth, right? So you are a wealthy person, right? And as a result of having that mindset, you will do things that wealthy people do, like, I don't know, get up early, work hard, plan things, have goals. And then as a result, you're going to have that like the end result thing being the wealth, right? And that's like almost a byproduct of being of the identity. So you start with the identity. So you say, hey, I am a person who is good with people, who is loving, who is caring, who makes other people feel like $1 million. And then as a result, you'll do those things. And then as a result, you're going to have people around you and you're going to have the results. So be, do, have, as opposed to have, do, be. The third principle I like is what I call enlightened self-interest. So what's the right course of action to take? So a lot of what I teach is about good decision-making. So what's a good decision? And I like to think that a good decision is the one that serves the most number of people for the longest amount of time. So enlightened self-interest means making the choice that's good for you in the long term, because that ends up being good for everybody in the long term. So for example, you know, you have a bad boy and you think, ooh, cute, you know, hot, rides a motorcycle. This could be fun. I'm attracted to him. Okay. So if you go for that, that's a short-term solution. You know, it may work out for a month or two, and then you have a whole lifetime of heartbreak, and that's not good. Right. So I think of like the bad boy as like cheesecake, you know. It's tasty in small doses, but if you make that your diet, you're going to be fat and sick, and that's not good. So you want to go for healthy food. You want to go for good relationships with, you know, solid people who make you feel good about yourself and are catalysts to your growth and fulfillment.
So you don't turn into an emotionally fat and
exactly.
Healthy.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's like people don't think that these things have like a blast radius, right? You go out with one bad boy, he breaks your heart. Now, nice guy comes along. You're not ready. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm a little hurt. I'm, you know, I'm rebound. I'm this, that, the other. So these things, you always pay a price. So I know I'm going to forget one of the five. So
I got you covered.
Oh, really? Okay. What's the next one?
Yin yang.
Oh yes. Yin yang. Okay. So we're talking about Taoism. So you got to have some Taoism in there, right? So that little symbol you see that is called the Daiji Tu, the little black and the white swirly things mm-hmm. with the dot of white and the black and the dot of black and the white. So the deal with that is that, you know, the white symbolizes the masculine, the black symbolizes the feminine, and there's a little bit of each in the other, right? So what does that mean? This is actually quite profound. So the way the world operates is by the principle of polarity, right? So you have positive charge, cathode, you have negative charge, anode, you have protons, you have electrons, and that's how you get current. That's how you get energy flowing, right? You have a magnet, it has top, bottom, you know, north, south. That's how you get the lines of energy flowing. You have gravity, high, low. That's how you get like water flowing down, right? So if it's flat, nothing happens. If you have a plus and plus, they repel. If you have negative, negative, they repel. So the similar principle applies with humans, right? So one person is going to be the more masculine pole, usually the guy. One person is going to be the more feminine pole, usually the woman. The feminine receives, the masculine gives, projects. So you want to have that in your relationship. If you want to have that kind of, if you want to have a healthy, happy, you know, dynamic relationship, you want that dynamism of the energy flowing. Otherwise, there's no flow. So this may seem really obvious, but if you think about it, you know, we live in a society where the men are feminized, right? The men are told, oh, you know, you should tamp down your, you know, strong, strong masculine drive and, you know, be softer, more sensitive. Don't be such a bully. Don't be such a brute, right? On the other hand, women are masculinized, like, oh, go for it, lean in, grab it. You know, there's entire books and movements about this now, right? And so what you get is this flattening out. The men are more feminized, the women are more masculinized. So they're both kind of meeting this neuter territory, which has no polarity, right? And so the contrast of that is what? I think a really good illustration of that is partner dancing. in contradistinction to this lack of polarity. In a partner dancing, one person is definitely leading and one person is definitely following. And if both people play their role right, both parties end up having a lot more fun.
Yeah.
Whereas if both people are struggling for the leader, both trying to follow, it's not fun at all. So in the playground of life, decide who's going to lead and decide who's going to follow. Does that mean it does not mean you look any worse? Does that mean you're less important if you're following versus leading? It's just a different role. And the goal of each person is to make the other person look good on that dance floor. So, you know, keep that in mind. And what's number five?
Get out of your own way.
Get out of your own way. I love that one. So that's also a very Taoist Eastern philosophical concept because it makes no sense. How do I get in my own way? I'm standing here. I'm not in my own way. But if you think about it, right, often the only impediment between what you want and what is, you know, and what is out there, right, is you. For example, you know, what are women told when they're young? They're told nice girls don't talk to guys first, right? So there you are at this party, at this bar, whatever, and there's a cute guy. And there's no barbed wire between you and him. There's no electric fence. There's nothing. You can just walk up there and say hi, but you don't. Why? Because there are cultural barriers inside you. There are stuff that your mom and your dad told you. These roles that we play. So the idea is to kind of examine what these assumptions are inside of you, what these unexamined beliefs are inside of you, and kind of gradually think about, is this serving me? Who is this? Or where did this come from? For example, I've told people this before. I had my first kiss when I was 19. I was a virgin until age 23, in no small measure because I was raised in a Muslim fundamentalist country that said, thou shalt not have sex before marriage. And, you know, at age 23, there's my girlfriend, horny and in pain, and I'm thinking, how is this making her happy? How is this making... This makes no sense anymore. So at a certain point, you have to decide what works for you and get out of your own way and just move confidently towards your own happiness and fulfillment and figure out what that is. So those are the five principles, and they manifest in various forms in the techniques and the various other teachings.
What's the most surprising thing that you've heard from women, just feedback on your book that you maybe didn't expect?
Well, the women have been very generous, and you know, this was completely unexpected because I really thought I was going to get drawn and quartered when I put this out. I was like, okay, here's a guy telling women what to do. But they seem to appreciate the point of view of a guy. And that's been very surprising and gratifying. And, you know, I'm kind of like the customer. So I can say, okay, you know, this aspect of customer service needs improvement. This aspect is great. But let me take a second and think about that. One of the more surprising and gratifying things that women have told me about the book is that it brings them back to themselves. I'm like, what does that mean? Even I'm not even sure what that means. But it was one of my goals to make women realize that they have real power, and they have power all the time. It's just that they forget to exercise it. So, you know, I'm sitting there, and to me, it's completely obvious that, you know, this woman is smart, she's beautiful, and obviously I'm attracted to her, but she doesn't have some kind of sixth sense radar to sense that in me. So I have to convey that to her. So as a person who actually wrote a book about it, then she gets to hear that from me. And then she's like, oh, wow, I really do have power. Thank you for reminding me. So that's been pretty surprising. Because to me, it's completely obvious, but it's something that a lot of women miss in themselves.
What do you think that power is? Like, let's talk about that for a second. We were actually talking about this at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
That women have way more power in the relationship than I think they realize most of the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, I've written books for guys, I've written books for women, and they both come to me and say, oh, the other party has all the power. They can't both be right. So, and this is something that's evolutionarily determined in this particular species, namely Homo sapiens sapiens, the men pursue, the women are pursued. So the women have more power in the courtship phase. Beyond that, who knows? You know, that's specific.
It's arguable.
Yeah, beyond that, it's specific to every relationship. But built in, if you are the pursued, you have more power. And so every woman has the power of sex appeal just by virtue of being a woman and by virtue of being the thing that men are programmed to pursue. And also every woman has the power of being the goddess, of having the power of light, of being able to light people up. And, you know, with a smile, with a touch, with a word of praise, that's real power. You can make somebody's day. You can be somebody's answered prayer. And that is the big part of the power that women forget about. The sex appeal, you know, there's enough things in the environment, billboards, magazines saying, oh, this is what you should be, up to the point that it's almost disempowering, that they think that's their only source of power. But really, if you wore no makeup and kind of, you know, dressed normally, but you were out there making everybody feel like a trillion bucks, then guess what? That's real power. And it's real power also because of the way that human beings are rigged. We're altruistic beings, and we're very in tune to one another's emotions. Supposedly we have these mirror neurons, and mirror neurons, their only job is to feel the mental and physiological state of another person. And this has great evolutionary adaptive use. And as a result, when you make somebody else feel great, you feel great. So here you are, you know, woman going around making everybody else, you know, glow like a 10,000 watt bulb. And as a result, you start to glow like a 10,000 watt bulb. And guess what? People want to be around that. People are like, who is that girl who's so lit up, so kind, so generous, making everybody feel great? And I know women like that. And you know, the sad part is I've only met like a handful who really exercise that power. And, you know, there I am sitting there, and she's giving me all these compliments, and like, she's read the book and she knows exactly what's in it. She hits exactly every point of pride I could possibly have. And the next thing you know, I'm flying, and I'm like, if every woman knew how to do this, you know, the world would be an amazing place, and none of them would be alone.
Yeah. Women like that can wrap just about anybody around their finger.
Absolutely.
And not even in a manipulative way. Just like, people just have a desire to fulfill the person who makes them feel that way.
Absolutely. And it's such powerful reciprocity. And, you know, somebody once said flattery works on only two kinds of people, men and women. But it's true. Even when I've done it as an exercise, even when people do it just blatantly to flatter me, it still feels good. So go out there, make people feel great, give compliments, and appreciate. The gift of appreciation is so rare. Men or women, if somebody is going around appreciating other people, you will rule the universe.
Why do you think there's so much, I feel like there's a lot of fear behind dishing out compliments and making people feel good. There's a lot of resistance.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
That's an interesting question. Well, you know, it's always a little anxiety provoking to meet another member of the species that you don't know, no matter what animal species you are. So that may be part of it. There's fear of rejection. And also it's something that has not been inculcated to people. People have been trained to do this kind of thing. So perhaps it's just a matter of practicing it more and more. And also noticing when somebody does it to you, how good it feels, then you'll be much more willing to do it too. But yeah, I think probably rejection, fear of rejection is a big part of it.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that if it has such a positive effect on relationships, and there's so many people who just feel so much resistance to doing something so simple and harmless.
And effective. And free.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the same thing with diets, right? I mean, your example was great because we often choose the cheesecake.
Yeah.
And it's not like we don't know better. Most of us out there know that the right thing to do is go have a green juice or a salad or, you know, like lean protein. But it's really difficult to do that for lots of reasons, only one of which being immediate, the desire for immediate gratification. And I think the same is probably true of relationships.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of scary. I mean, like, the vulnerability piece, right, is really, really hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a hypnotherapist and somebody who's been studying humans for some time, one thing I've learned for sure is that anytime you see a whole bunch of people doing something totally unreasonable, there's a deep-seated, like, biological evolutionary reason for it. They're not all crazy at the same time. It may look like it, but that's usually not statistically plausible. So, and that's when I try to look deeper and see what's going on and why people are doing this. And, you know, and rejection is one of the big drivers of human behavior. And if we used to live in these tribes of 150 when everybody knew everybody else, mm-hmm. right? And you go hit on the wrong girl, right? You go hit on, you know, the chieftain's girl, then you get expelled from the tribe. That's death. You're done. You're toast, right? Exile was death. Now you live in these cities of like 10 million people. Rejection has basically cost of zero. But people are still behaving as if they lived in the savannah, you know, 10,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So these are, you know, it's understandable, but we're also evolving. You know, evolution is happening. You live in these cities, and social evolution is happening at an incredible pace. So once you become cognizant of that kind of thing, you can rewire your own neurology by going out and doing new things and trying new things, by just willingly complimenting everybody. Or something is much simpler than that. This is an exercise that I encourage people to do, is to like sit at a park bench, or you're at an airport or somewhere on a bus or something, right? And just every once in a while, every 5 minutes or something, one person walks by and just say, inside, not even out loud, may you be happy. That's it. May you be happy. I wish you happiness. I wish you love. And just imagine like going into their body, like from behind, imagine going like towards the area of the heart. And you do this and it changes your entire physiology. Just do it right now. It's like, may you be happy. May you be happy. You know, and you start to feel good and then it becomes easy. And then you can do it out loud. Then you can do it in person. So, but you start with a thing that's easy and less fear provoking, anxiety provoking, and then you can move up from there. So just kind of work with your neurology as opposed to trying to bash into it.
Right.
That's a good point. I love what you said about very few women having those qualities or the ability to wield their power.
Yeah.
What do you think it takes if you kind of go through your mental Rolodex of the women that you would consider to be people who really exude power?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they do differently from all the other women?
Well, I think the best way to think about this is through specific examples. And these are women that I know. And the most powerful aspect of their presence is their gift of appreciation. They're just like, wow, you know, you're so great. Love what you do. Thank you so much for coming. Can you come over to dinner, blah, blah. And you're like, you feel valued all of a sudden. And you're the same person you were 2 minutes ago. But here's somebody who has validated you. So they have that. These are also women who have accomplished a lot in their lives. And so they know they can do this. They know they can do that. So they know that exercising their feminine power does not diminish anything from them. In fact, it makes them even more powerful. So for some reason, they've gotten used to this idea of exercising feminine power. And they know that it works. Let's see, who else was there? Oh, yes. One other thing that they have in common is these are women who have become comfortable with their bodies, and they're all different kinds of body types, you know, some tall and skinny, some a little more full bodied, and curvaceous, and some yoga teachers, some, you know, yoga practitioners, and they've made their peace with their body and they use it as an instrument of joy. I mean, I've seen them eat food and they just love food and they love to cook and they love sex and they're completely unabashed about it. So they just, you can feel life force, vital energy moving through them and it's contagious. And in the end, that's what attraction is. I mean, basically we're attracted to life force and people who are smiling and exuberant and energetic and giving you energy. Why would you not want to be around that? In the end, we're all trying to beat back death by, you know, one more minute. So it's like, okay, this person makes me feel more alive. This is good. So that's basically what they're doing.
That's such a great analogy.
I mean, that's why people have kids. It's like,
No, it was awesome. I loved it. My head just went into like spun into 12 different directions as a woman. My head just went into 12.
Oh, really? Tell us about it.
It's so interesting to me. Like even something, like from a female perspective, even something as like simple as that, there's so much wrapped around things like body image or like all of that. And it doesn't surprise me just thinking, going through my list of friends, it doesn't surprise me that like so many women have lost their sense of power.
Yeah.
And I just find it fascinating, like what actually gets people over that hump, you know, like what is different about people, about the women who just exude incredible energy when they walk into a room versus women who are incredible people, but don't necessarily exude that same energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is something about when you say life force, the first thing I think is, yes, that's true. The second thing I think is, I think it's really just about the containment of life force because we all have it.
Yeah.
And it's about like how we cap it. So are we going to let it flow through us so that people experience it? Or do we suppress it by a lot of the rules that we place around ourselves as women? And I think men too. And so that kind of leads me to my next thought because this idea that women have more power in relationships or the ability to kind of control the success of a relationship keeps coming up over and over again. And I don't know if it's perhaps just some resistance that I have to that concept for some reason, but something about it doesn't feel quite right.
Yes.
And I think part of the reason is because as I sit here and listen to you talk and listen to one of the women, you know, who wrote the Surrendered Wife talk about her book, it all makes sense to me. But I think about men and I'm like, well, if a man walked into a bar and he was complimentary to me and super charming,
mm-hmm.
I'd probably really like him.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the balance of power mm-hmm. in a relationship between a man and a woman.
That's right. And I really like the part about, you know, there being blocks inside to energy. Everybody has the energy. Everybody has the life force. And to me, like, growth and continued flourishing as a person is all about removing your internal conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the whole idea of, you know, I want to be sexy, but I don't want to be slutty. Well, guess what? That's an internal conflict, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to somehow reconcile that and make it such that you flow. You know, I want to be nice, but I don't want to be a pushover. Okay. So how do you do that? So, and the more and more you get in touch with what is and who you really are, as opposed to trying to compare it to some outside standard, which may or may not exist in a magazine, in a movie or something like that, the more you can just flow with you. And so that's a topic for a different day, perhaps. but as far as, relationships and power, men versus the men, and women, who has it, who doesn't, I like a model that one of my teachers, proposes. David Data is his name. He's written a lot of books on relationships mm-hmm. and, you know, very eloquently. He says that the men determine the direction, the women determine the depth. And these are two mm-hmm. qualities that every relationship has, right? But it's also a little bit of that whole yin and yang thing, right? So the yang is the direction, and that's like moving out directed, right? And the woman determines the depth, and depth is kind of a feminine concept anyway, so mm-hmm. like a well or... And so... in that sense, both parties are involved and no one person has hegemony. I do think that in the context of courtship, it's the woman who can have a lot more power than the guy if she knows her power.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have the relationship, then it's much more of a team effort. And then, you know, that goes in a certain direction because of the guy, and it becomes a certain depth because of the woman.
Do you think that that presents problems for women and men in relationships, that the balance of power shifts somewhat dramatically after the courtship period?
Well, that's why you want to meet somebody who's a good match, right? So, and research shows that people end up having more successful relationships with people who are better matched with themselves. So, and you know, there's all kinds of theories done, and, you know, there's papers written, economics papers written, saying, you know, the equity theory of relationships and marriage, everybody brings a certain amount to the relationship, and if they're even, then it goes on. So if you're super pretty, then you end up with somebody who's also very good looking, right? If you're super pretty and the person's not good looking, that person brings maybe wealth and power, right? And we've all seen these matches, right? You have youth, the other guy is a little older, but he has a lot of influence. He's sitting on $1 billion. So in the end, it's all about that fit. And I think if you have a good fit, then things just proceed organically, right? Whereas if you have something that was forced to begin with, and, you know, this guy was really reaching, it's like, oh, I really want the prom queen. He finally scores a prom queen. He's going to spend his whole life trying to please the prom queen and
right.
keep her, right? So, and I tell the boys that, look, you don't necessarily want to go for the prom queen, because then you end up with this thing called the winner's curse in auctions. So if you when you win an auction, you get to be the guy who is willing to pay the most amount for that. So guess what? You almost always overpay, right? So so that's the problem with chasing anything, right? Because when you get it, that means you're the one person who is willing to put in the most amount of effort, right? And that's usually too much effort. So how do you make it such that, you know, it's the right amount, and you want to be, you know, with somebody who's approximately a good match for you. Same kind of attractiveness, same level of education, same level of social pull, something like that. Does it have to be in every single sphere? No, but it helps that you have some points of contact. And that's, if you know real life couples, you can see how the match works. Mm. And the couples that actually last, that's how it works. If there's a big mismatch, it's just not going to work.
What do you do if you're the prom queen?
But if you're the prom queen, yeah, that's a tough one. So first of all,
find a prom king.
Yeah, so that's one way of doing it. The other is to avoid being the prom queen, because it's actually not an entirely enviable position, because...
Just throw the crown on the floor and...
Exactly, or do it like
burn this ash.
What was that movie? Mean Girls, where they, you know, they give the yeah. the thing away, the crown away. So yes, So one is you may want to avoid being the prom queen. And it's, it, there's a whole different story about, you know, what to do if you're an exceptionally attractive woman. That because if you're less attractive, you don't have as many bids, and that's a problem. But if you're very attractive, now you have a whole bunch of bids, sometimes from very sketchy sources, that's a problem too. You know, so it's still a problem. So, but if you're the prom queen, so being that being a proxy for somebody being very desirable, you're saying, for example, you probably want to be with someone who either does not value those things that the rest of the world values as much, right? Or is supremely secure in himself or herself, as equally attractive, equally smart. So these things just don't become an issue. If you end up being somebody's trophy or prize, that usually ends up not being a sustainable situation. Mm-hmm. Again, because the courtship has to end at some point. But if, you know, if you're always trying to keep the other person happy, because like, oh, I totally won, now I have to keep her happy. It's not going to work. So.
Got it.
So I have a more personal question. Mm. How has all of this knowledge of how just relationships unfold and how they work, how has it affected your own life?
Complicated it.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's got to do one or the other.
Yeah. Well, you know, a big part of Taoism is stop thinking and solve all your problems. So a lot of Westerners go into Eastern philosophy and end up, you know, gathering more information and thinking even more, which completely defeats the purpose. So, what has been helpful to me is just meditating. I started meditating a few years ago, and that kind of clears your mind. And you know, getting more to the point of just seeing the world as it is and encountering each situation on a day-to-day basis, on an individual basis, as opposed to thinking up, oh, this is what I want, this is not what I want. It is also complicating because I hear about a lot of relationships. I hear about results. I hear about what other people do. I'm the recipient of all their stories, especially their sob stories and disasters. And so this makes you very sensitized. And so if you let it, it could make you reluctant to venture out, take a risk. And so it's taken a lot of active, shall we say, reconsideration. If I have like an instant reaction to something, I'm like, no, you have to go and do this. Right. You have to go out there. You must take the risk. You must put yourself out there. And so...
Because I'm sure you hear a disproportionate number of sob stories and heartbreak as compared to the normal human being.
Right. And you know, and you see like a certain sign and you're thinking, well, that's never going to work. So you never pursue it. So if you let it, that can be very dangerous if you're the person gathering all the information. So it takes conscious effort to... just kind of say, you know what, you don't actually know everything about this person or how things are going to unfold. So give love a chance.
So for people who want to get into meditation, like me,
yeah,
I've been thinking about it a lot lately.
Yeah.
Where would you recommend they start?
Yeah. Meditation.
Or where would you recommend I start?
You know, it's the top two most transformative things I've done with my life, and yoga being number one, and yoga, meditation kind of growing out of that. And I would say two things. First, start small. So 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. Whatever you will actually get done, do that. Okay? So I do 20 minutes a day. For a lot of people, that's way too much. But 3 to 5 minutes, even that can have a very positive effect. And so pick up some simple procedure. So the procedure I do is that I start out with is called the Hung Sa meditation. So basically, you do three things. You focus, you close your eyes. You focus on the spot between your eyebrows, the third eye center, they call it some. And then on the inhale, you say on the inside, Hung. And on the exhale, you say Sa. And these are sacred Sanskrit syllables that don't necessarily mean anything. They just focus the mind. Mm-hmm. And as you do that, the act of saying those things and also focusing on that really calms the mind down. And so... start small, have a procedure. And the third thing is go easy on yourself. So the central practice of meditation is not to have this totally clear, calm mind with no thoughts whatsoever. The central practice of meditation is bringing your mind back from the distraction. Okay, so you have a thought, you're like, oh, hello, thought, that was nice, come back. Because that's the thing you're going to be doing the most, right? People, you're going to get distracted. This is what the mind does. You have the cerebral cortex. Its job is to think stuff. So when it does, hey, say thank you, come back. And so what you do is you strengthen that muscle of coming back. And you keep on doing that, and that makes you much more able to come back to that center of calm when something real happens, right? So just practice that. Go easy on yourself. Have a simple procedure, and you're good to go.
Cool. Thanks.
I'd also use this app on, I have it on the iPhone. It's called, I think it's called Meditation Timer. Let me see what it's called here. I use it every day. Insight Timer. Yeah.
Insight Timer.
And what that does is it allows you to time it, right? And then it's there, but it keeps a record. So right. If you go 5 days in a row, it's like, boom, boom, boom. You did 5 days in a row. So it's self-reinforcing. It has a little community nice. Around it. So it actually gets done.
And I know Calm.com has really cool ambient noise and guided meditation. If people
there's all kinds of gizmos, yeah. But in the end, it's about your ass on a cushion. And oh, the other thing is do it at a set time every day. I do it right after I wake up. So that way it's tied to my waking up. It gets done first thing in the morning, done.
So how has it helped you? I people talk about it all the time. It's interesting. I'm interested to hear like what exactly the benefits are.
Well,
why the benefits happen.
Yeah. So what you're doing is you're training mindfulness. So training being present wherever you are. So the central malady of our times is that people are trying to get through everything, right? They're trying to get through their meal, like scarfing it down while talking and not paying attention. And it's fast food to start with. They're trying to get through a trip. It's like, okay, go here, go here, go here, hit 15 cities and get to the end of it. They get through sex, usually in 10 minutes or less. They don't even feel what happened, right? Trying to get, they get drunk before it happens and afterwards they don't talk about it. And the idea of meditating is to bring back your presence. And you're actually living longer by doing that, because if you didn't experience 10 minutes as 10 minutes before, you experience as a minute, and now you do experience as a 10 or maybe experience as 20 minutes, you just live longer, right? You just prolong your life. And you're also savoring what's happening, and the whole richness of sensory experience is happening. And then you're also taking more in more of the good. You become aware of, oh, look, you know, I'm sitting here, pants are dry, roof over my head, food in my belly. This is great, right? And so you become aware of all the stuff that you can be grateful for. So
I'll have to make sure to wear dry pants when I meditate.
Yes. That helps. Helps focus the mind. Buddha say dry pants while I meditate. And but most of all, it gives you this tool when crisis hits. Okay. So, and crisis could be anything, right? And it gives you a choice. So now, you know, somebody flip you off on the road. Your natural reaction maybe to say, well, screw you too, and flipping him right back. But when you meditate for long enough, you get this little buffer zone. You get this extra like 3 seconds or 5 seconds to actually choose how you're going to feel. And you realize, wait, I don't have to get worked up about this. I don't have to get mad. I don't even know this person, right? What's there to get worked up about? And now you can go in a different direction if you want to. And since you've practiced hundreds and hundreds of times to take your mind out of distraction and back to the center, you can do it again. You just go whoop, right back. And now you have like this, you know, you have this eye of the hurricane smack in the middle, which is calm. Craziness happening all around, which is the world all the time anyway. And now you have that. You have the safe haven anytime you want. It's there.
That's very cool.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. I like it. And that's one thing that I encourage people to do above all else. And, you know, after about 5-10 years, people eventually pick it up. It took me 10 years. So...
I think I'm going to start tomorrow morning.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not going to wait 10 years.
Fantastic. Yeah, just do it.
Any other pointers?
Are you
growing out of yoga? Is that what you said? Or?
No. I said my meditation grew out of yoga. My meditation practice.
Oh, cool.
Yoga,
I got you.
Yoga is a little bit like a moving meditation. And at the end of every class, they usually have this pose, corpse pose, Shavasana.
Mm-hmm.
And
love Shavasana.
That's very meditative. And it helps to be beaten down physically and, you know, dehydrated and not able to move to get your mind in a calm spot.
Right.
But there's got to be an easier way. So just meditation, that's the easier way. And yeah, I highly recommend yoga as well. That way you get both.
Do you practice on a daily basis as well?
Yoga, I theoretically go twice a week, but really. Yeah.
That was a great way of putting meditation.
Yeah.
The idea that the practice is less about having a clear mind and more about the art of your thought going a certain way and then being able to pull it back, and how that applies to real life scenarios when there's stress or anxiety or anger or anything else.
Yeah. And that was a revelation. I, you know, one of these talks by these old school meditators, people who brought it here from India, and that's the thing they said. I'm like, oh, well, that makes, and also lets you not beat yourself down. Yeah. It's like, oh, I had another thought. I'm a terrible person. It's like,
I thought the whole time.
That's not the point of meditation. The point is not to give yourself a whole different kind of low self-esteem about something.
It's literally to center yourself, like to bring yourself to the center of that hurricane.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that you can, there's tons and tons of meditation practices, kinds of meditation you can do. And what you're cultivating is what they call in Tantra witness consciousness. So, and in psychology, it's called metacognition. And the idea is that you're sitting there, you're having a thought, right? And you kind of step back and you go, oh, look at me having that thought. If you think about that, it's really weird.
You're perceiving yourself.
Yeah. And so the idea is like, here's a jumble of madness and you're one step removed from it and you can look at it. And when you do that, it's much easier to access and identify with that, because that's what all these Eastern traditions say. They say, you are that witness. Yes. You are not the thought.
The essential self is the observer of the thoughts.
It's the consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's not the electrical impulses going nuts. And, you know, the simple Buddhist trick is they say, okay, look up at the sky. You see the clouds in the sky. You are not the clouds. That's it. You're the thing that sees the clouds, right? You're having a thought about a cloud. You are not the cloud. So if you're having a thought about anger, awful person, I'm fat, butt's too big, didn't get the raise and get the promotion, it's not you. The you, the real you, is having those thoughts. It's like the TV screen versus the show. Mm-hmm. So you're the TV screen. You're the TV. TV. Sounds a bit square, but you get the idea. So
it's a good metaphor.
Okay. I wanted to go back to something that you said in the very beginning, about not necessarily believing the idea of the one.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you believe in that concept? And what do you believe in lieu of that concept?
Okay. So I believe that the idea of a soulmate is a pernicious and potentially destructive notion that's been perpetuated by us by Disney movies. And people need to be disabused of that, because they're going around and they're surrounded by people who could be perfectly great partners, you know, have a great time, provide for one another, be catalysts to one another's growth. But because, you know, you're not having this cataclysmic, amazing feeling inside, you're like, oh, that's not it. Right. And usually when you have those butterflies in your stomach, that's like the evolution sign for you to run. I mean, it's a danger sign. It's adrenaline. That's what it is. So, and usually when that happens, you're also abdicating your good sense and rationality and you end up making bad decisions. So, but that's, I'm digressing here. Let's go back to the whole idea of the soulmate. So, but when you do that, you're actually denying the abundance of the universe, right? There's any number of people out there who could be good matches, and any relationship in the end is going to be requiring a certain amount of compromise. We're like two, you know, pieces of Play-Doh. They're not completely hardened yet. And, you know, you kind of mold to one another and you kind of fit. Nobody's going to be like a perfect match. So, that said, some people are going to be better matches than others. So you should wait and assess that. But at the same time, you know, I've been to workshops and seminars where they put us around in the circle, you know, guys on the outer circle, women on the inner circle, and they say, so, okay, go face to face with someone, okay, and then look them in the eye and imagine you truly love this person. This person is your soulmate, right? And this person is, we were meant to be together forever. Look directly in the eye and say it, and then move on to the next person, do it again. And you realize you can do that with anybody, right? And in a way, nobody is special. The thought experiment I tell people to do is like, okay, go some neighborhood, say, you know, in New York, Upper West Side, or here in Noe Valley or something, where everybody's, let's say everybody's hitched. Go to a neighborhood where everybody's married or in a relationship, right? Well, guess what? Everybody on that street that you see, there's one person that they think is the most wonderful person in the world. Well, guess what? They can't all be right. So they're all wrong. No one person is the one most wonderful person in the world. Everybody's wonderful. And the thing that makes people wonderful is the fact that we're all miracles. You start out as one cell, and now you're 70 trillion. Think of the U.S. Congress, 535 people who can't get along. 70 trillion cells get along. You're here, you're talking, you're, you know, your food's digesting, you sleep at night, your heart keeps on beating. It's kind of wild, right? And also, you've dodged any number of, you know, murderous cabbies and crazy bikers and potholes and childhood diseases, and you're alive. I mean, this is a miracle. So that is what makes everybody special. The fact that you're here, you're alive, and you have a heart and you're able to share that, as opposed to, oh, this person went to so-and-so school. Oh, this person, you know, had a $10 million IPO. That is not special at all, right? That's like, it's like such a tiny, tiny bit of distinction between the from beyond the miracle that you are to that. So it's the common humanity of all of us that makes us special. And if you're able to see that, you can be in love with anyone. That said, make a good choice, make sure it's a good fit. And, you know, so you're catalyst for one another's growth, but soulmates, you know, there's any number of good soul friends out there for you.
So this idea of catalyzing one another's growth comes up a lot. And I don't know that I necessarily expected it before I came into this project, but there's a consistent concept or theme in the interviews that we do with both experts and couples that marriage isn't for happiness, it's for growth. And I believe Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled, said, described love as a commitment to another person's growth. So
extending yourself for another person's growth.
So I'm curious, because do you think that that's kind of the heart of what love is? Because everyone kind of talks about this idea of like, you can, I'm starting to realize that you can love a lot of people. And that a lot of being in a relationship is about being wholeheartedly ready. But what is that part that you just said right there is the part that I'm having trouble with. Like, how do you, what does it mean to pick a right person or someone who's like, what does that even mean? You know, like if you can love just about anybody, then like, what's that little extra thing that like you have to like pick the right person and then it's easier to love that somebody?
And then it comes down to fit, and it's going to be different for any one person. And I can talk about my experience, maybe the experience of some of my clients, some of my readers. But the way I think about it is that, look, I'm a happy guy. I can cook my own meal, right? And I can read books and learn a lot of stuff. So what's the point of being in a relationship? Why would I even want that? What is the deal, right? And one point is, yes, you know, you want to have offspring. So it's nice to have this kind of unit that helps the offspring grow and have an environment in which they learn and they flourish. But another thing is, you know, what's the point of life? Why are we here at all? What is the deal? I mean, do you just kind of eat and sleep and poop and that's it? I mean, that it seems it could be, right? But my what I've come up with is that in the end, it's a game, right? You start somewhere, you end somewhere, and between now and the end, you decide you want to play whatever game you want to play, and you play it well. And for me, that game is, how do I use my faculties to be a, you know, more happy, more fulfilled, and more complete version of myself? How do I grow as a person, right? So moving towards greater joy, greater empathy, greater, you know, all these things, generosity, all these things that, you know, make life richer. And I can do that myself to a certain extent. But I've also been in relationships, so I noticed that, wow, this person really brings out more of that good stuff. So if there's any rubric that I would use as to what the fit is you kind of notice what kind of person you are around that person, around this partner, right? So, you know, I've been on dates, I've been with girlfriends, and I notice that I'm going around, I'm just like criticizing things. I'm like this snarky, nasty, sarcastic version of me. I'm like, well, isn't that interesting, right? So I'm thinking, oh, that's just me. But then with another person, suddenly I'm like really sweet and kind. And the point is, we're all these highly charged, energetic creatures, and we're communicating with one another in millions of ways that science has not even come up with, right? Stuff is happening all the time, right? And so you just notice whether you like yourself better when you're around this person. Am I nicer? Am I kinder? Am I more generous? Or am I like petty, mean? Am I scared? Am I afraid that something's going to happen? This person put me on edge. And so it comes back to the whole idea of fulfillment is a feeling, not a person. So notice how you feel. If you feel like you're better, happier version of you, then hallelujah, keep going. And sometimes that person who's the catalyst does not look like the person you thought. Especially for women, women are capable of, like, you know, making a guy who makes him look good feel good. Guys don't have that power as much, I don't think. We're kind of stuck. It's like, she's hot, she's not hot, done. Unfortunate for guys. But the idea is that, you know, that person may not be packaged the way you thought that person was supposed to be packaged. May not as blonde or as brunette or as tall or as short or whatever that you thought it was. But the feeling is going to be there. And in the end, that's what is real. So one of the principles from A Course in Miracles, which is a great book. It's quite a mind-twisting little piece of work. But one of the principles from The Course in Miracles is only love is real. Okay. It means everything else is fake. So do you feel the love? And what is love? Love is like this idea of mutual growth and flourishing and extending yourself for the growth of another person. So only love is real. So go for what's real. Don't go for the signs and symbols. And humans, you know, for better or for worse, we are symbol binding creatures, right? If you tell them that this piece of green cotton is worth something, they'll believe it and they'll like die for it, right? If you play poker and you substitute a piece of plastic for the piece of cotton and say, this is worth something, they'll die for that, right? And they'll do crazy things for that. So, and the same way we go for symbols. The symbols are on magazine covers. They're on TV screens. Like, oh, I want that symbol. I want Kate Upton. She might be a nightmare. You have no idea. She could be a totally bad fit for you. She, you know, her feet might smell. You don't know, right? But there's the symbol, right? And people go for the symbol. So the key thing, again, in meditation brings you back to that Eastern philosophies. They're like, go for what's real. Be anchored in the now, in the real. And then you can see things. And the thing that's real is how you feel.
Thank you for that. That was very, very useful.
Okay, good.
I have one last... What?
No, it was good. She's been asking that question a lot, so I think...
That was the most satisfactory answer I've gotten so far.
Oh, thank you.
I really like it.
Roger.
I have, of course, a follow-up question to that.
Oh, sure.
And it is the feeling that you produced. The first thing I thought of when you said that was I went back to how certain women can just make anybody feel alive and loved and open. And I still wonder how much of it has to do with the chemistry between two people and how much of it has to do with what an individual person brings to the table to everybody.
Mm.
So, and I'm not sure what the breakdown of that is exactly, but.
So chemistry versus just like
general disposition. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. There's the sun, right? There's the sun and the sun shines on everything and the sun is generous that way. However, different things benefit from the sun in different ways, right? So if you are a plant, man, are you psyched that there is sun? Unless it's really dry, in which case the sun is like burning you up and you're not happy, right? And if you're ice, like, oh my God, I'm melting. Okay, so the sun's doing the same thing, but there's different compatibilities here, okay? So in a similar way, you can be somebody who's super charming and nice and makes everybody feel like $1 million, right? But there's like this biological compatibility stuff going on too. And apparently a lot of it's mediated by smell. So apparently I can smell whether your immune system is compatible with my immune system, and compatible meaning actually different. The more different they are, the more compatible we are, because that way the kids apparently have the most diverse complement of immune markers, which makes them more resistant to disease, which means that the human species perpetuates itself. Hallelujah and amen. So, so there is
science.
Yay, science.
So the idea is that yes, you can be like this super generous person who makes everybody feel great. I mean, have you been to like some kind of presentation by the Dalai Lama?
Mm-mm.
No. Okay.
Never had that privilege.
Yeah, but somebody like the Dalai Lama or Bill Clinton, you're like, oh, wow, he loves me and me only. Well, okay.
The Dalai Lama or Bill Clinton, is that what you said?
Yes. And or, yeah, similar. Same idea. Same idea, right? And they're both virgins. Wait, maybe not. Anyway, so...
Oh, my gosh.
So the point is that yes, this you can be the super radiant person, but in the end, that like intersection of you and another person in an intimate relationship, there's going to be like additional compatibilities that will be necessary. So, and also, it's just not really practical. Let's say you're on some stage and everybody's like, "Oh my God, you're the greatest!" I mean, you know, Oprah has a lot of fans; she can't date them all. So, does that address your question?
Oh, I mean, that addresses so many more questions.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Here we go.
Oh, good.
Thank you for that.
Okay, good.
Well, my last question is, I'm just curious, what's the magic question?
Well, the magic question, yes, for the ladies is, or for the guys too. So the idea is that, what do I talk about, right? You're on a date, what's the conversation? And you can go and say, well, you should talk about this, you talk about, you know, economics, or you can talk about, you know, baseball, because that's what he likes. But I don't think that's terribly useful. It's also, you know, times can change. The best question to ask, especially a guy, is what's important to you about that? So you say, oh, what are you interested in? Well, I'm into, you know, balsa wood model airplanes. Well, what's important to you about that? Well, you know, I like the craftsmanship that goes into it and flight, you know, sense of freedom, blah, blah. And what's important to you about that? Guess what? This is an endless conversation right here. You can keep on asking that. And so It's a little bit like why. So you're asking for motivation, right. But why can sometimes come off as judgmental. It's like, well, why do you do that? Well, I don't know. I like it. Right. But what's important to you about that? That comes out as like, oh, okay, this is what's important to me. So what you're doing as a woman, when you're asking this question, which is a little bit like an interview question, is you're kind of peeling back the layers of this guy and getting to more and more core information, deeper and deeper information about him. And he's revealing himself to you. And there's almost no question that works as well. And it's easy to remember, hey, what's important to you about that?
So that's great advice for couples whose relationships have grown stale as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's always depressing to me to go to a restaurant and see a couple who's been married forever and they just sit there and eat their food and don't even talk.
Yeah, and that's a big part of having a good relationship. Again, I emphasize that I specialize in the dating part of things, and the relationship I leave to the experts, like, you know, John Gottman, who's written all these great books about it. And however, never assume you know your partner. I mean, this is what happens to the 50% of people who get divorced. Like, oh my God, where'd that come from? You probably took him or her for granted. So always be asking. People are infinitely complex. Never assume. And a question like, what's important to you about that? And it's also useful when somebody does something annoying. It's like, well, obviously they did that for a reason. So what was important to you? As opposed to, why the hell did you do that stupid thing, you fool? So, you know, tends to work a little bit better.
Cool. Good advice.
Just kidding. I have one more question.
More questions.
What's the passion formula?
The passion formula. Okay. The passion formula is very simple. So have you read Romeo and Juliet when you were in high school?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what was the deal with them? They were star-crossed lovers in love, but forbidden. What was the problem?
Forbidden to be together.
Exactly. There was a barrier. So attraction plus barrier equals passion. Think of a dam, right? You have a river. Great, river. That's great. That's attraction, right? But you put a dam there,
right.
You know, like a whole bunch of water behind the dam. Now it's like just waiting to break through. So that's passion. So, and, you know, you can create it naturally by being of two opposing clans that are each other's throats, like the Capulets and the
Montagues.
Montagues,
yeah. Or you can create it artificially. Oh my God, I'd so love to get you on Thursday. Oh, I've got to go, you know, dye my poodle. Friday's not good either. How about Monday? Now he's got to wait. It's like, or, oh, but you know, I live in this city. Oh, you know, it's too far. Anyway, any kind of
obstacle
where there's already attraction, right? So there has to be, if you have a dry creek, you put a dam, nothing happens. There's already something happening and now you build up. But guess what? If the creek is running even just a tiny little rivulet of water, you put the dam, you will have passion. So there you go.
Very cool.
Love it.
Well, thanks for spending time with us tonight, man.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. Where can people find you?
Oh, yes. People can find me online. TaoofDating.com is the website. All the books, all the seminars, everything is there. And you can probably find my Huffington Post articles from there, too.
We'll do a little linkage from the,
that'd be
from
good.
The website.
And you can write me. I do my best to respond to everybody, which is fast becoming impossible. But I love you anyway. It's Dr. Ali at TaoofDating.com. T-A-O of Dating. .com.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Thank you, Ali.
All right.
It's been a pleasure.
This week's music was brought to you by Miko, and you can find a link to her music on the blog, as well as the theme song by Maddie Blades. I hope you love them both. I know I do. And have a fantastic week. I love you.